the cord. So what I'm going to do today is wrap up the discussion on deadlocks. There's just a little bit remaining, and then I'm going to do a review for the exam. The exam is, I think, a couple of weeks away. But what we have covered until today is only stuff that you need to know for exam 1. Starting Thursday, okay, that's all material for exam 2. So we would have finished all the material we need for exam 1. I could have scheduled it earlier, but I didn't give enough advance notice, so I'm giving you the benefit of the time and doing a later exam than usual. Okay? So hopefully you'll have enough time to prepare and whatnot. Yes, question here. Oh, when is the past exam? The past exam, since somebody wanted me to force you to do it, will be the next homework. It's going to come out, it's going to be given out this week. Okay, so that's going to be homework, whatever, 3 or 4, what is it? Are we at homework 2 now? Okay, homework 3 is going to be last semester's exam. Okay, and as soon as you turn it in, we'll give you the solutions. Okay, so we can't give the homework with the solutions, obviously. Okay, so that's what it is. Alright? Okay, so let's come back to the lecture. So we were talking about deadlocks. Okay, so the important things to keep in mind are there are 4 conditions necessary for a deadlock. First, you need to remember what a deadlock is. It's a condition where some threads are waiting on resources while holding other resources, and then they're all waiting on one another and no one is making progress in the system. Okay, this condition is referred to as a deadlock. It's different from starvation. In starvation, some threads are making progress while others are not. In deadlocks, the whole group is basically just stops making progress. Okay, so there's a distinction between the two. There are 4 conditions we said that are necessary for a deadlock. These are not sufficient, only necessary conditions. Mutual exclusion, okay, hold and wait. You hold some resources, wait for another. Others, no preemption. Okay, no one can force you to give up resources or locks you hold, and circular wait. Okay, so we looked at those conditions. You should know those and what those means. Okay, and then what we were doing were to lot of figure out what techniques we need to address deadlocks. So there's deadlock detection and recovery, which says you detect deadlocks after they have occurred and then you recover from them by killing threads or the processes and whatnot. There's deadlock prevention, where you put some stringent restrictions on what cannot be done by programmers or what the system will not allow you, and thereby one of those 4 conditions always becomes false in your system. As a result, there will never be a deadlock. Okay? Some conditions cannot even be true because you put some restrictions to prevent it from ever happening, not a deadlock. Today we are going to do the third of these 3 things, which is deadlock avoidance, which we started looking at last time. Okay? So what does deadlock avoidance do? Deadlock avoidance allows the system to do some extra checks when requests for resources or requests for locks come in, and then you see if granting those resources results in an unsafe state. Okay? If so, you will not allow that request. Okay, last time we did a numerical example with tape drives. Okay, we said these are the requests, these are the resources you can request, and then as request comes in, you check whether states are safe or not. Okay, so we are going to do a more general version of that algorithm called Banker's algorithm. Okay, there is going to be a wrap up of the topic of synchronization. There will be exam review. Okay, just reviewing all the material that's going to be on test number 1. Okay, so let's start with deadlock avoidance. So the tape drive example that we were looking at numerically, okay, this is the algorithm that you use, okay, using our graph. Okay, so this is your resource allocation graph. Okay, the circles here represent threads, the square boxes represent resources. Okay, there is one circle for every, one node for every thread, there's one node for every resource. Okay, the edges indicate something. Okay, if the edge goes from a thread to a resource, what does it tell you? Okay, there are 2 kinds of edges. Edges that go from threads to resources, edges that go from resources to threads. Okay, what's a edge that goes from a thread to a resource? A request. It's a request edge. It says this thread is requesting that resource. Okay, and the other way is that this resource is held by that thread. Okay, that's an assignment, that's a request. Okay, so those are the edges we already know about. Here we are going to add a third kind of edge, a dotted edge. A dotted edge is basically resources that this thread can request in the future. Okay, it has not requested them now, but when the process starts up, it will declare saying these are all the resources it might request over the course of its execution. So this is a potential request that could be made in the future. That's a dotted edge, which we call a claim edge. Okay, claim edges are requests you can resources rather can claim in the future. Okay, so now the basically all the requests that are going to come in for resources will be claim edges. Okay, those are the ones that you can request. So in particular, thread T3 might make a request for R2. Okay, because it said it could ask for it, and maybe it does make a request. Okay, now clearly R2 is free. It's not been assigned to anyone. There's no solid edge that's going out of R2, so R2 is not even assigned to any thread. So in principle, you could actually assign R2 to this thread when it makes a request. Okay? The question is, by doing so, will you actually cause the system to go in an unsafe state? Okay, if this resource is available, the thread is requesting it. Okay, so in potential, you could grant that request. But you only want to do it if the system stays in a safe state. Okay, if the system goes in an unsafe state as a result of that allocation, you don't want to grant that request at this point. Okay? So how do you know whether the system goes in a safe state or unsafe state? What is it that we did with this graph earlier?
Oh, if it makes a loop,
doesn't it? Okay, so we said we look for cycles.
Yeah.
Okay, so now let's suppose that the system, the OS can pretend that it has actually given that resource to that thread. So this, if you did that, then this arrow would flip and it would become solid, indicating that it's an assignment edge. Okay? So you flip this edge, you make it solid, and you look for a cycle. If a cycle exists, that means that you can actually go into an unsafe state. Okay, yes, question.
If that one flipped, wouldn't the arrow from R1 to T3 disappear?
R1 to T3?
Wouldn't the assignment go away if it was assigned to a different?
So that is resource R1, this is resource R2, two different resources. Okay? So this is to think of, this might be a disk, this may be a printer. So currently T3 holds a lock on the disk. It is asking for a lock on the printer.
Separate lock.
Every resource has its own lock. Okay? Different resources, different locks. Yes, question.
But is that a good solution? Because doesn't it take a long time to check the resources?
Okay. So we are not, yes. The question is it an efficient or a good solution? Isn't cycle detection expensive? It is expensive. Okay? Now all we are trying to figure out is, even if you are willing to pay the price, is it a good thing for R2, resource R2, let's call it the printer resource, to be given to T3. Okay? And as I said, intuitively all we are trying to do is we say, if this resource are granted, this edge would flip, it would become a solid edge, saying now this lock has been given here, and then you look for a cycle. Indeed, there is a cycle. As you can see, this will basically, actually the example should have been T4 made a request, so this would flip actually. So then that would result in a cycle. Okay, if T4 asks for R2 and you give it, then you may actually get a cycle. Not may, you will have a cycle in the graph with the claim edge. So that's an unsafe state. Okay, because then, why is it an unsafe state? Because if T3 then makes a request, then that edge also becomes solid and you actually have a cycle at that point. Okay, so you don't even want to go there. Okay, so what you will do is you will say, even though R2 is available, the lock on R2 is free, you will not grant it to T4 at this point. Okay? You will make it wait. Okay? So instead of an allocation edge, you will make it a request edge and wait. A request edge will actually go in that direction. So it will still stay the same way, it just becomes solid. So you will make it wait until one of these edges goes away. At that point, you can grant it that resource. Okay? So this is essentially whatever we did last time, the example. In an algorithmic form. So what you do is you look for claim edges that have been requested, you flip them, see if there is a cycle. If there is a cycle, you say cannot do it, wait. Okay, wait for in the future until one of these edges disappears. If the resource gets released, one of these edges goes away, then if you grant it, there will no longer be a cycle. So you wait for the potential of a cycle to go away, and then you are done. Okay? So this is basically called deadlock avoidance. You are avoiding deadlock by making requests for resources wait, even though the resource may be available. Okay, you are being very conservative, in other words. Okay, so now this is how algorithm works, but the only thing is that it only works for a single instance of a resource. So you can only have one disk and one printer and so on. What the next algorithm we look at is a generalization. It's called the Banker's algorithm. It's essentially the same algorithm that we looked at in the previous slide, but this is can handle multiple instances of a resource. Okay, it requires you to do matrix manipulation of the form we did last time with the tape drive example. Okay. So what does it do? It forces threads to provide advanced information about all possible resources they can request. Okay. Same as previous slide. So these are all the dotted edges. You have to provide all this information ahead of time. Okay. So in other words, you specify all these dotted edges when you start up. So system knows how many resources and what can be requested. Okay. So now what we will do is we will do a check. Every time a request comes in, we will say, will granting that request put the system in an unsafe state? If so, you make the thread wait. If not, you grant that request. Okay, that idea is the same, but the algorithm of how you do that is different. Okay, it's not a cycle detection algorithm, it's just a slightly different algorithm. Okay, this is a pseudocode for this algorithm. Okay, so if you remember last time we had several matrices. There was one called max matrix. For every thread and every resource, you can specify how many, whether you want to request it or not. Okay, that's your advanced specification. There's an allocate matrix which says what has been allocated. There's a need matrix. We'll see an example so that all of this becomes clear. Okay. So the same matrices are here, what we did last time. Okay. So this is basically the pseudocode. Okay, it looks long, but it's actually very simple. Okay, so the only parts to look at is really this part and this part. There are only two important parts. So that's an allocate method. That's a request that is coming into the system. Note that we made it synchronized. Okay, this is Java code. So we want the banker's algorithm to only run for one thread at a time. So you can manipulate these matrices appropriately. So you take a lock on all these matrices by doing synchronized, and then you run this algorithm. Okay, so you can check for deadlock detection or rather deadlock avoidance for one thread at a time. That's why they are synchronized methods. Okay? So what are you going to check? First thing says if request greater than need, then you throw an error. Okay? If your request is greater than what you said you might need when you start up, that's clearly an error. You are asking for more than you said you would ever ask for. Okay? Just throw an error saying you cannot ask for more than what you said. So then I think that part is just error check. The next check is if request is greater than avail. Okay? Avail says these are the available resources. The request says this is what I am requesting. So you ask for three, let's say, disks or three printers. Maybe you want to print three jobs in parallel and there are only two available. Okay? So requested number of resources exceeds the available resources. What will you do? You will wait. Okay? You just say there aren't enough resources. Just wait until they become available. You just make the request wait. Okay. This is condition. So remember that this is our condition variable here. This is a monitor class. So that's actually a condition variable. That's why you have that while there. Okay. But that's the same thing that you do with condition variables. Okay. So now let's assume that you didn't make an erroneous request. Let's assume that there are sufficient resources available. So now you will come here. Okay. So you will now check whether granting that request puts you into an unsafe state. Okay, you have sufficient resources, but now you want to check. Will this cause the system to go into unsafe state? Will that result in the equivalent of a cycle? Okay, that's what you are going to do here. And the way you do that is you basically call this function saying, is the system state safe or not? If so, if it's unsafe, you will wait. Okay, if not, you will actually grant it. And here is the pseudocode for safe state. Basically, what you want to do is the same thing we did last time. The way you check whether a state is safe or not is you assume that all threads make their worst case allocation of request, worst case need. All the threads make request all of the resources they want at once. Then you say, is there a way to satisfy each of them one at a time so that everyone is happy? Everyone gets their max resources, nobody is waiting. Okay? So you have to find, in other words, a sequence of processes that can execute one after another and yet meet their worst case needs. Again, we are going to do an example like the tape drive example last time. Okay, in the next slide. So if that is the case, then it's safe. If not, then you are in an unsafe state. Okay, that's essentially what this code is doing. You are going to do some vector comparisons to check whether you can find that sequence. Okay? Now, I'll show you an example of how we do this within pencil and paper. Okay, so you can get the basic idea of what that pseudocode does. Only thing I want to say here is this is order mn square. Okay, for m threads and n resources. Not a cheap algorithm is the point that you are making. It's an expensive algorithm to run. Okay, it's a square of the number of resources because you are checking for all possible ways in which you can satisfy this resource. I mean this request. Okay. Nevertheless, if you want to do deadlock avoider, you have to pay this price for every request. Every time you did a lock, let's say, system had to check against all the locks and all the resources, this kind of stuff, your lock granting will be actually very slow. It's no longer a matter of checking if it's just the lock is available or not. We'll have to check whether granting that lock will put you into an unsafe state. Okay, so let's do an example. Okay, so here is the current system state. Okay, so let me explain this table here. There are four processes or threads P0 through P3. Okay, three resources A, B, and C. Would you mind fixing that? There's something creaking there. I think you just need to. Okay, thanks. Okay, that's good. Okay, so three resources A, B, and C. Four processes. Okay, the max is what each process specify the startup time, say how many resources of each type can you ever request through your execution of this process. So P3 has said as it executes it, at most it can request 0 resources of type A, 6 resources of type B and 5 resources of type C. This is specified at startup time. In other words, the programmer would have to write code so that when the process starts up, it basically tells the OS saying this is what this process can request. Okay, typically you don't do this, okay, but in this kind of system you would have to do this. You as a programmer would have to figure out what resources are needed and specify this. Okay, this is the allocation column. This says how many resources of each type are currently being held by this process. Okay, here it says you are holding 6 resources of type B and 3 of type C. Okay, allocation has always to be less than max. You can never get more than what you asked for. Okay, and so that's allocation. This says these are the number of free resources in the system. Okay, there's 1 of type A, 5 of type B and 2 of type C that are still free. Okay, that's the system snapshot. Now we'll assume that so first we will check whether this current state is safe or not. Okay, then we'll assume that a new request comes in and we'll see whether granting that request leaves the system in a safe or unsafe state. Okay, so the first exercise is given this system snapshot, if you are asked saying is this a safe state or not, okay, you should be able to figure that. How do you figure that? You run Banker's algorithm and say let everyone make their max request, let everyone ask for this. Okay, so basically you already hold this, you can ask for something more. Everyone, all processes come and say I want the max I all said I could want. Okay, and then you say given what I have left here, okay, can I satisfy those requests in some order? If you find one order, one particular order or sequence, you are done. Okay, because then it says there is no deadlock. Those threads or processes can proceed in that order. Okay, so we'll do that exercise. Okay, so now first we have to answer these questions to get there, sort of breaking the solution into steps. First question is how many resources of type A, B and C are there in the system? How many resources of type A do we have? 3. Okay. This is how many of A have already been given out. This is how many of A are free. So totally there will be 3. 2 have been used, 2 are in use, 1 is free. Then you do 9 plus 5 and you do 9 plus 2. So that basically gives you 3, 14 and 11. Okay. That tells you that many, those are the number of resources in the system. Okay. Then it says what's the contents of the need matrix. The need matrix basically says how many more resources can I ask for, can each process ask for. Okay, so this is max, that's what is allocated. Okay, the difference between the two is what you can ask for. Okay, so always this is what I wrote down last time, need is max minus allocate. So you take this matrix, that's a matrix. take that matrix, you subtract the two, and you get need. Okay? The last question is whether it's in a safe state or not, and it turns out it's in a safe state, and we'll see why. Okay, so let me go back, and so these are the solutions to those questions. So it says 3, 14, 11, and that's the equation, resources total plus available. This is the need matrix. The need matrix basically is just the difference. So here your 001 has been allocated. P0 cannot make any more requests. Okay, so this will become 000. So you take this and this and you subtract, so that gives you 075. Okay, that's the need matrix here, and then you subtract this and so on. Okay, so basically that's your need matrix here. Okay, now that's what, when you make the worst case request, each process asks for these many more resources. Question is whether you can grant those. Okay, to understand that, how many do we have free? We have 1, 5 and 2 free. Okay, and this is what, these are the requests that have all come in at the same time. So 1, 5 and 2 comes from here. That's what is free. These are the requests that have all come in. Okay, question is, can you satisfy them in some order? Okay, if you have 1 of A and 5 of B and 2 of C available, is there some process that can just execute to completion based on this request pattern? Okay, P2 and P3. So first of all, P0 should be able to complete, because if there is nothing more it can ask, it's already holding everything it can ask, so it should be able to finish. Okay, as soon as it finishes, we assume that whatever it's holding is released. Okay, so well, let's let P3 finish. Okay, so P3, what is it holding? It's holding 1 of C. When it finishes, that C, 1 of C will become available. So what is available will actually become 1, 5 and 3. Okay, so and P0 is done. These three are still waiting for their max request. So with this three resources, which one can we satisfy next? You said P2. So P2 can ask for 1 of A. We already have 1 of A free, so it can go next. Or P3 can ask for 2 of C. We actually have 3 of C. Okay? So either of those two can finish. Okay? So we can execute them in some order, doesn't matter. Let P2 go next. Okay? If P2 goes next, it basically finishes. It will release all of its resources it's holding. Okay? And it's holding 1, 3 and 5. Okay, so basically you add that here. So you have 1, 5. So what you have is 2, 8, 8. So now this is what is freed up. Okay, and we are going to let P3 also finish, because P3 also had, if we had enough resources to fulfill its need. So you basically release whatever it is holding, which is 6 more of this and 3 of this, and that basically gives you enough resources to satisfy this P1 075. You already have more than that there. Okay, so we identify at least one sequence in which these processes can proceed and all finish, even with their worst case requests. Okay, that tells you that this is the safe state. If you couldn't identify any possible sequence, and there is no way I can grant any process the resources it's requesting for and let them finish, then you are basically in an unsafe state. Okay, in particular, you may be in a deadlock, because you are holding for something and requesting something else. Okay, so this is safe. So the current state is safe. So now the question is, if a new request came in, will that actually take the system to a new state that is also safe? Okay, so in particular, it says the request from P1 has come in, it's asking for additional resources of 052. Okay, can Banker's algorithm grant this request? This is what Banker's algorithm does, whatever we did, paper and pencil. It actually finds the sequence. So P0, said P0, P2, P3, P1. It will find if so, is there a sequence like that. If so, it will say it's safe, and then the request will be granted. Okay. So now this is a request that's come into Banker's algorithm. So basically, we want to ask whether that will result in a safe state or not. The way you do this is you pretend that you granted that request and do the same analysis we did just now. Okay, saying that would be the new state. Is that new state safe or not? Okay, it will be safe if all of the threads can make, or processes can make, their worst case request, and yet you find the same sequence again. Okay, so for that you just need to fill this out, okay, and then you ask whether it's safe or not. So this is basically, I'm not going to go through all of those details, but Wait a second. What happened to the need matrix? So anyway, so here is first thing you check is that request a valid request? Okay, that was the error check we did in Banker's algorithm, saying are you asking for more than what you said you would ask for? Okay, so you ask for 052, what is available is 152. Okay, so you do have the available request, and it is also less than the maximum you said you would ask. Okay, so both of those things are true, and then you say now I will pretend that the request was granted. So this is the new system state. Okay? In particular, 052, this allocation is now 052 here. It was 100 earlier, as you can see. So this went from 100 to 152, because that's what you asked for. So that's the new system state. Okay, these things have not changed. Okay, so now you ask, so this is what is remaining in the system. Okay, you had 152, now you have 100. So is there a sequence that you can find again? You will see that the same sequence actually works again. P0 cannot ask for anything more, so you always let it run in this case. Okay, so it will release 1 of C, then you have 101. Okay, then you ask, what can I satisfy with 101? Okay, can I actually satisfy P2's needs, because there is only 1 of A that it can ask for, you have 1 of A. Okay, so you let P2 run to completion, so it will then release its resources. Okay, so you went from 101 to 236. Okay, with that you can satisfy P1's needs, and then you can satisfy P3's needs. So you will find the same sequence again. Okay, and then you will say it's safe. Okay, now Banker's algorithm does this in code. You will do this with paper and pencil. Okay, there are questions you can expect on an exam or on a homework. So you should be able to give a state like this. So if you are said, this is the allocation, this is the max that's available, reason about whether this is a safe state or not. You have to do exactly this mechanically. Okay? Any questions on this? Is there anything I can explain before you do it on a test? Are we going to give you a deadlock?
Like one of those that's like a deadlock, the solution is a deadlock, because that would be harder to figure out, wouldn't it?
Yeah, you might get. It's not that if I tell you that I will not give you one, then you will always find a safe state, right? No, it's not that difficult, because last time we did a tape drive example. Okay? Just go back to that example. You will find that it's very easy to figure out that there is no way to satisfy this. Okay? Of course, I mean, we will not give you something that has 20 threads and 15 different resources and figure out. That's going to take quite a bit of paper and pencil work. So the scenario will be relatively simple, but you need to be able to reason, saying this is why it's safe or unsafe. Okay. So that is basically going to be the end of the first quarter of the material of this course. Okay, this basically, we have finished processes, threads, and synchronization. Okay. The next big topic is going to be memory management, starting Wednesday, Thursday. Okay. So what I'm going to do is wrap up just do a recap of all the material on synchronization, and then that will lead into exam one review. This is basically where we will stop as far as exam one is concerned. Okay. You don't have to read beyond whatever chapter 7 or lecture 12. So that's all that's going to be on exam number 1. Okay, so let's do a synchronization wrap up. It's been quite a few lectures that have gone by. So we started with very low level primitives. If you remember, we said what are the very low level hardware features we have, that load stores are atomic, that you have the ability to disable interrupts, and then you have the special instructions like test and set. Okay? And we said, okay, how do we build on top of this? We said we can build several primitives using this, and then using those primitives such as locks, semaphores, monitors, now we can write multi-threaded code. Okay, so we have gone all the way from low-level hardware, very basic things that hardware supports, and we basically figured out how to build a lock class, how to build a semaphore class, how to build monitors and condition variable class. And we said, how do you use those classes to do programming? That's what you are doing in your lab. Okay, how do you write threaded code that does synchronization? So that's basically the big picture. So, so you need to be able to, given some of these primitives, figure out what are some advantages and disadvantages of using those primitives to do synchronization. Okay, so load store advantage is all atomic on all possible hardware. If you can just use simple load stores, then don't need any special hardware. Okay, disadvantage is it's very complicated to use just load store without any additional features. Okay, this was the too much milk problem. Okay, we were able to write a synchronized version of too much milk without using locks, if you remember. Okay, but it was very complicated because the solution was asymmetric. It was more complex to understand what was going on. So you can indeed write synchronized code using just load stores and nothing more. No locks, no semaphores, but your code is going to be very complicated, okay, especially as you have more threads. So you don't want to do that. Okay, so you want to use other hardware support to write simpler code. Okay, so that was basically, we said, you have the ability to disable interrupts. So the advantage there is, as you, while you are disabled and nothing can run, the disadvantage is if you disable interrupts for long periods of time, you are going to be in trouble in terms of, because everything on the hardware that's happening will either get queued up or dropped. Okay. Disk raises and interrupts are masked, nothing can happen. Okay. So you don't typically want to disable interrupts for long periods of time. Even in the kernel, this is done for very short instruction sequences. Okay. Because you are turning off an important feature of the hardware. It is there for a purpose. Okay, if you just turn it off and leave it off for long periods of time, things that you expect to happen will not happen. You click, do a mouse click, it will be ignored. That's an interrupt. Okay, system will not respond. You do a keyboard press, it will be ignored. That's an interrupt also. Okay, so your system will appear to not respond if you do this, but you can indeed use enabling and disabling interrupts as the basis to write your lock class or semaphore class, as we saw. Okay. Test and set are the special instructions that we said that allow you to check the value of a variable and store it back in a single atomic instruction. Okay. This is really the basis that is used to write most synchronization classes. Typically, you don't do this, you definitely don't do that, okay, as the only basis. So this is what is typically used to write your lock class. We did see an implementation of semaphores using test and set. And locks for that matter. So advantage is it actually gives you the basis to write most synchronization primitives. The disadvantage of test and set, as we said, where it needs some form of busy waiting. Okay? You basically sit in a loop testing and setting the value of a variable, waiting for something to happen. Okay? That consumes resources. Okay. So that's basically that table, quick recap. Any questions on that? Yes.
So in real systems, is interrupt disable what's used?
Is interrupt disabled? It's used. It's used. Typically, is used by the kernel to do special things.
Okay.
So the idea is, if a kernel, sometimes kernels themselves might be multi-threaded or preemptive. So kernels don't have the ability to implement locks. Kernels give lock to user-level program. If you want to do synchronization inside the kernel, that's the way typically it's done. Okay. If you do want to do synchronization at user level, you use kernel support using that to do it. Okay, so that's the way you can typically do. Now, if you are root, you can actually write programs that disable interrupts. Okay, but you can assume that bad things will happen if you do that. Any other questions on this? Okay, that's sort of the basis for where we started our discussion. We have then, since then, looked at three different synchronization primitives. Started with locks, and we did semaphores, and then we did monitors. Okay, so let's go back to locks. What is a lock? Lock is a synchronization primitives that support two methods, an acquire method and a release method. And the usage basically says, if you want to protect a resource or a critical section with a lock, you always do an acquire before you enter this critical section, and you do a release after you leave that critical section. So in other words, you protect any critical section with a lock acquire and a lock release. Okay. Initially, the value of the lock is set to free. Okay. Once the first thread to request a lock always gets it. Any subsequent threads that request that lock have to wait until the lock is freed up by the holding thread. Okay, that those are the semantics of the lock class. Okay, very simple primitive. And it's used widely. Okay. The next primitive we looked at was semaphores. Okay. Semaphores are a generalization of locks. Okay. There are two types of semaphore. There is something called a mutex semaphore, which is functionally identical to a lock. Then we said there's something also called a counting semaphore that generalizes that notion. We also saw a way to use semaphores to do scheduling, and we'll come back to that. So let's say how the semaphore class works. Initially, what do you assign the value to be? That depends on the problem. The value of initial value of the semaphore always depends on what you are trying to do. If it's a binary semaphore, initialize it to 1. If it's a counting semaphore, initialize it to n, where n is greater than 1. If you're using that to do synchronization of some sort, like you did in producer and consumer, you will initialize it to 0. Lock is always initialized to free. You never have a lock class where you sort of say, I set the lock value to be in use when you start. A lock is free. Semaphores are different primitives. The value can be, initial value can be 0, 1 or n. And there are two classes. Wait always decrements the value. If the value is greater than or equal to 0, the thread will basically continue. The value goes negative, the thread will block. A signal unblocks a semaphore, basically increments the value. And if the value is greater than or equal to 0, it will basically unblock a process. Otherwise, it just increments and does nothing. Counting semaphore allows you to do what? Has anyone used counting semaphores? Yeah. No?
Manage multiple resources.
Yeah, manage.
It's the same type usually. So you have 5 printers and this is useful for that. Or you could have, say, I don't know, 5 candy factories.
Yeah. So you could have 5 candy factories. So you actually use counting semaphores in your candy factory example, right? Did you not have semaphores that were initialized to n? That the empty or full, one of them gets initialized to n. That's a counting semaphore. This is counting the number of slots that are free. So you have n slots, there are n resources of the same type. You protect it with a counting semaphore. When the value goes to 0, producers cannot produce. So you actually used it already. What is the relationship between locks and semaphores? You need to know that. So as I said, essentially a mutex semaphore is equivalent to a lock. Mutex semaphore also called a binary semaphore. But that and lock are functionally identical. Next primitive was monitors. So what does monitor? Monitors are higher level primitives. The problem with locks, semaphores, etc. is it's easy to get the code wrong. I presume that you found that out with your lab too. Unless you write perfect code from the very beginning, you probably have made mistakes. Typically, it monitors because they are higher level primitives, it is easier to write code. Because, as I said, the way to, in Java, to use monitors is you just use a keyword on a class and it turns that object into a monitor. Automatically and internally protects it with a lock. The system takes care of acquiring and releasing locks at the right times. As you enter methods and leave methods, you don't worry about it. So it is a higher level primitive that allows you to write, makes it easier for programmers to write code. But in terms of expressive power, all of these are identical. It's not like one is more powerful than the other. You can write any synchronization or solve any synchronization problem with any of these three. It's not the case that some problems cannot be solved using locks or for monitors for that. Any problems that we have talked about can be solved by any of them, which means that in terms of overall power, expressive power, their ability to do things, they are all identical. So more a question of how much code you will write to do it. So now what are monitors? Monitors basically include a lock and a zero or more condition variables on any object. And any method on the object is always automatically protected by this lock. And condition variables allow you to go to sleep inside a method and atomically release the lock. And when you wake up from sleep, the lock is given back to you. That's basically what monitors do. It's condition variable. The way you use it is you have basically three methods. You can do a wait. This automatically releases the lock you're holding and goes to sleep. Signal will wake up a thread, if there is a sleeping thread, and give it the lock. Broadcast will wake up all waiting threads and only one of them gets the lock. That's basically how you use monitor. Okay, one thing you should be able to do, which I guess you have not done, is be able to write some pseudo code in the for the exam for this using monitors. Okay, you probably now know a little bit about writing code using semaphores, since you used that for lab 2. Yes, you should be able to do that for the exam. In tomorrow's discussion section, we'll go through some exercises. Anthony is going to review monitors and maybe review some pseudo code that illustrates how to use monitors to solve some problems. Okay, but this is something you should be able to do. If you are said solve the candy factory problem using monitors, okay, you should be able to at least at a high level understand how to do that. Okay, so those are the three primitives. We started with low level hardware support, we looked at three primitives, and that should allow you to practically solve any synchronization problem. Okay. The last point we looked at, or the last topic, was deadlocks. We said you have to use these synchronization primitives well, otherwise you are going to have problems. Okay. In your code, all threads will block, nothing will work. Okay. So we said that's a condition called a deadlock. If a deadlock has actually occurred in your system, those four things are true. There is mutual exclusion, which means you have locks and stuff in your system. There is hold and wait, which means some threads are holding some locks and waiting for others. There's no preemption allowed. The system does not allow the OS to forcibly take back locks. Okay? And most importantly, there's a circular wait. There are threads basically that are waiting on one another, and there's a cycle in this wait. Okay, so basically you will wait forever. Okay, if I wait for someone and they wait for me, we are going to always wait, because neither of us is able to move forward. Okay? We looked at three ways to handle deadlocks. Okay? The deadlock detection and recovery basically says let deadlocks occur. Okay? We will not do anything beforehand. We will try to detect that a mistake has occurred and correct for it after the fact. Okay? So here you basically just see if every so often you run some cycle detection on your resource allocation graph. If there is a cycle, then you might say, okay, that's a deadlock and the thing is moving, so that's a deadlock, and you start killing some threads and so on and so forth. Okay? Deadlock prevention says I will be conservative upfront. I'm going to impose some restrictions on what you can do. Okay? And then you basically prevent deadlocks. And this is typically how programmers actually work. If you write a large piece of code that has lots of different synchronization primitives, you would basically write your code to do that. Okay, you don't expect to have deadlocks and expect the system will fix the problem for you. And the most common way to do this is you internally impose an ordering on all of the locks or resources, and if threads are requesting resources, they have to acquire them in that order. Okay. This is the most simplest programming rule that most programmers will use when you write large pieces of code. That you will say, here are the 5 or 7 locks in the system. If any thread needs more than one, here is an arbitrary order. Doesn't matter what order you pick, but then every thread should respect that order. So you write your code so that you always acquire locks in monotonically increasing order in that list. Okay. If you follow the simple rule, your code is going to be deadlock free, because it will prevent circular wait, because you only basically go one way. You will never have something going the other way, where you hold a lock lower in the list and you are waiting for something earlier, because you should have gotten that before you even got here. Okay, so this is simple programming rule. Okay, that if you write large programs, that's the rule to follow. Okay, and then your code will be free of deadlock. Okay, that's sort of what most people will use. The last one we looked at is deadlock avoidance. This also requires support from the system, and that's what we did today. Banker's algorithm. Okay, where you make requests, system does some checks, says maybe I can grant it to you, maybe you have to wait. If you are in unsafe state, you are made to wait. Okay, so those are the ways of handling deadlock. So this is all the stuff about synchronization that you need to know. Okay, before I move on to the exam review, let me pause here for a few seconds, see if there is any questions on any of these things. Yes, question.
For monitors and locks, what's like the main difference between monitors and locks? Is it just that the monitor can sleep and rewire?
Yes, so what's the main difference between monitors and locks? Monitors are constructed using locks. Okay? Now, typically in code with locks, you are not allowed to sleep. There is no way for you to sleep inside a critical section and give up the lock. You have to release the lock. Monitors allow you a way to do that atomically. That's really the difference. So it allows you to make your code simpler. Yeah, if you write the same code using locks, you would actually have to look for some conditions and do lock release and then reacquire the lock and do something. So make code becomes more messy. Here you can write clean code. Okay, you can do the same stuff, but it'll more work. Okay, so let's start with exam review. Okay, I'm not going to redo whatever I just said on synchronization, except to say what kind of questions you might expect. Okay. So we'll start with the first topic, which was processes and threads. Okay. You should be able to say what is a process. Okay. Define a process, for instance. Okay. Process is a program in execution. It's a dynamic state of an executing program. Okay. That's what a process is. Okay. Then you need to know what is a process control block. Okay. We did this. We said it's the data structure that is maintained by the kernel to track all the processes in the system. Yeah, that's what the OS keeps track of. There's one entry in the PCB for every process in the system. Okay? That entry tells the OS everything it needs to know about the process. Who owns the process? What's the memory allocated to the process? Where in memory is the process resident? What's the priority for the process? What's the state of the process? Okay? Everything. What files does the process have open? All of this stuff is tracked in the PCB. Yeah, so it's basically the data key data structure that the kernel is going to use to do process management. Okay, that's what it is used for. What information does it contain? I just told you that. Okay, that's a PCB. Okay, the next thing is what kind of states a process can be in. Okay, we looked at the five or six states: new, ready, running, waiting, terminated. You should be able to know what these states are. You should be able to draw the state transition diagram. Okay, saying from what state can you go to what other states. Given some pseudo code, you should be able to say this is the list of all the transitions you make. You already did that exercise in the class. Okay, so same kind of stuff. Okay, what do they mean? What causes the process? Okay, how does the OS keep track of processes? It uses the process control block, okay, to keep track. Okay. You should be able to know what's a context switch. Okay. Context switch is basically the functionality where the OS suspends the execution of one process, saves its register state into the PCB, picks a new process for execution, loads its state from its PCB into the register, and starts executing that new process. Okay. All of these steps are collectively referred to as a context switch, because you're switching from one process to another. Okay, the mechanics of switching to one process to another is a context switch. That's what happens. So what causes a context switch to occur? There are two reasons you might have a context switch. What are they?
Time slot expires
is the first reason. Okay, you have your time slot expires, you have to give up the CPU. It's time for somebody else to run. What's the other reason?
Process ends,
okay. Yeah, then there are three reasons, yes. I.O. Okay. So I.O. is basically where you voluntarily give up the CPU. You do I.O., can't run on the CPU, you go to wait state, your time slot automatically ends, you gave up the CPU. Or your timer goes off and your time slot expires. Of course, process ends or terminates, also the time slot ends and the context switch occurs. Okay. You talked a little bit. Yes, you have a question.
Is there a context switch when switching between threads?
Is there a context switch when switching between threads? Yes, there is always a context switch regardless whether you switch between threads or you switch between processes. Okay, we said that context switches are cheaper when you switch between threads. Okay, simply because you are switching between threads of the same process, you don't need to save the memory management information in the PCB. That's common for the process, the thread that you are suspending and the new thread that's resuming. So there is less information to save in the PCB and less to restore. Okay? As a result, context switches between threads of the same process are always cheaper than context switching between processes. Okay? That's a more heavyweight operation, this question.
So when a process finishes, it goes into terminated, right? So is it still saving all the information and then only getting that removed during terminated, or is it just not saving it at all?
Okay, so when you go into terminate, you're asking whether you need to save anything in the PCB. That's your question, right? So whenever your context switch happens, regardless of whether you terminate or not, by default you will save whatever is there into the PCB. Okay, but then the OS knows that the process has finished, then it will start the process of deallocating the PCB entries, which means you take the memory and you say now it's freed up, you take this data structure, you throw it away, etc. So it will take some effort for the OS to do that, so that all of that bookkeeping happens in the terminate. But you always save by default, okay, and then you do whatever the OS needs to do.
Does the context switch happen in a user level thread as well? Or
does the context switch happen in a user level thread? Yes, any time you switch from one thread to another, you have to do a context switch. If you have user level threads, the thread library does the context switch. Okay? So in that case, you really don't, the thread library has to have the equivalent of its thread control block data structure that it's keeping in the library. You are not doing things at the kernel level, you are doing things at the user level or within the library. Okay, context switch is just simply the task of switching from one thread or one process to another. Who does it is a different issue. Okay, in some places the kernel will do it, in user level thread the library would do it. Yes, but still a context switch nevertheless, yes.
For our candy factory programs, would they be kernel level switches or user level switches, because we're using the Java stuff?
Okay. Question is, for candy level, not candy level, for candy factory program, are you doing user level or kernel level? Because you are doing this in Java. Right? So the answer is really, it depends on the implementation of your JVM. Depends on the Java implementation. The Java implementation is written using kernel level threads, then your threads are going to use kernel level context switch. So JVM is written using user level threads, then your context switches will be user level. Now the important thing is the JVM, the Java spec or the JVM spec doesn't prescribe whether to use kernel or user level threads to implement Java threads. It leaves that to the implementation. Okay? Now that said, the most of your standard Sun JDKs, if you are using Sun's implementation, they are using kernel level threads. That's how they are written. Okay, but you can actually go and find JVMs that basically are written using user level threads as well. Okay, but so if you are using the standard stuff, they would probably be using kernel level threads. Okay, so where were we? So we said process context switches. Okay, so did context switches, there should be something on scheduling. It's on the next slide. Okay, so then you need to know, then we started talking about a thread. Okay, we said what is a thread? Basically a thread, multi-threaded program generalizes the notion of a traditional process by adding multiple sequences of execution that share the same address space. Same address space, multiple concurrent execution streams that are sharing that address space. Each thread has its own stack, each thread has its own registers. Okay? But they share the text segment, they share the heap. Okay? That's basically what a threaded program allows you to do. So it can basically have multiple things within the same piece of code executing concurrently. Okay? That's the definition of a thread. Then we looked at kernel level threads and user level threads. So you need to know what they are. You need to know the advantages and disadvantages. Right? Kernel level threads are threads that kernel is aware of. Kernel provides explicit support. Right? User level threads are threads that kernel doesn't know about, built using user level libraries. We looked at advantages and disadvantages. Okay? One is more lightweight than the other. Which one? User level thread. The kernel is not involved. Library functions are used to manipulate. Okay? Much cheaper to make a library call than to make a system call. Okay? So it's cheaper to do user level threads management, but from scheduling perspective there are again pros and cons. The advantage here is you can use whatever thread scheduler you want. You can write your own library threads package using a library, implement some funky custom thread scheduler. Are not limited by CPU scheduler in the kernel. Okay. Disadvantage is that these threads are not visible to the OS kernel. So if one thread may blocks on IO, the entire process is blocked because the OS has no visibility into what's inside that process. It doesn't know there are 20 other threads that may be on the ready queue, because it doesn't know of the existence of that. So it blocks the whole process. Okay? In kernel level thread, you get better concurrency, because if one thread blocks, the others can still be scheduled by the CPU. It knows about that there are these threads. It can track their states independently. Okay, so it can schedule some while others are blocked. Okay, so there are those advantages and disadvantages to keep in mind. Okay, and we looked at process creation. Okay, we looked at this fork and exec calls. A fork allows you to create a process. Okay, you need to clearly understand the semantics of a fork. When you do a fork, you basically make a memory copy of that process. The child process is identical in all respects to the parent process. That's the same code, same everything, except that it has a separate process ID. Okay, and the only way you distinguish between the parent and the child from this point on is the fork behaves differently in the two. In the parent, it returns you the ID of the child. In the child, it returns zero. Okay, so you need to understand that. You need to understand what exec does. Okay, exec takes the program you have specified as the argument. It wipes out the current memory contents and loads that program and runs it. Okay? Fork and exec are the two most commonly used system calls to start up any new process, to terminate them and so on. Every process has a parent that created it. Okay? And you basically create them using a fork exec pair. Okay? What you also need to know is if you are specified a scenario saying, let's assume there's a process A, create three child processes C, A, B, C and D. For B, let it create a grandchild, let's call it E. You should be able to write the fork and exec calls to do that. Okay? I provided the standard template that you use recursively to solve whatever fork exec problems you ever encounter in practice or in an exam. Okay, so you need to know what that is. That was very simple. So basically it always you write this as CID, the child ID, you say fork, and then you say if equal to 0, put the child code here. Whatever the child needs to do goes in the if, else the CID is not equal to 0, that's what the parent will receive. This is the code in the parent. Okay, so this is your standard template to use. If you want the child to fork a grandchild, you put a fork in here and have the same if then there. Okay, so then you can say this is what the child does, this is what the grandchild. This you need to be able to understand, okay, how to write. So we did some exercises here in the class saying have a one process create a child, have a child create a grandchild. The parent is going to print something, the child will print something else, etc., etc. So you should be able to write pseudocode of that form. Okay, so that is basically this part, right? Pseudocode for process creation using fork and exec. And wait. Wait is the last call that I didn't mention here. Wait allows you to wait for a process of the specified ID. Okay, so there's this wait call, also called wait PID. You specify a process ID, and this will block until the process with that ID finishes. Okay, so this is typically used for a parent that is waiting for a child to finish. Okay, you are doing the equivalent of that in your lab. If you are waiting for all the producers to finish, the parent thread that created all your producer threads will do an equivalent function to that. You are not going to call wait PID, that's a system call, but you are essentially doing that. Okay, any questions here? Before I talk about CPU scheduling. Okay, so last of the process scheduling stuff before we started talking about synchronization was the CPU scheduling. Okay, so these are all the policies that are implemented in a kernel or possibly in some threads library. That basically makes the choice of what process to run next. Whenever there is a context switch, the scheduler CPU scheduling policy runs. Okay, context switch or when a process ends, the CPU scheduling policy runs and it says this is the next process to run. Okay, there are various policies. Simplest one is first come first serve. That says basically schedule them in the order in which they are right. Okay, before I say talk about policies, there are two classes of schedulers broadly, preemptive and non-preemptive. Okay, in a non-preemptive, once you have chosen a process for execution, it will run all the way to completion, or it until it waits blocks on IO. You don't have the notion of time slots in a non-preemptive scheduler. Okay, you let them run and let them either finish to completion or give up the CPU by doing IO. Okay. In a preemptive policy, which is sort of default in most operating system, you have the notion of a time slot. Okay, when you are chosen for execution, you can at most run for that length of the time slot. Okay. So when the time slot expires, then the CPU scheduler runs again. Or you can, of course, give up the CPU by finishing or doing IO before your time slot ends. Okay. So you need to know which of these are preemptive and non-preemptive, first of all. Yes, question.
Preemptive is no time slots?
No. Preemptive means I can preempt you, which means there is time slot.
Okay, okay.
Non-preemptive means I can't preempt you. I can't make you give up things. Okay, if I can preempt you, that means there has to be a time slot that allows me to preempt you. That's the way you preempt. Questions here? Okay. So preemptive, non-preemptive should be clear. You should know which of these are preemptive, which ones are not. Several of those have both variants of both. Okay, so it's not that they are either preemptive. First come, first serve, by definition, non-preemptive. Okay. Round robin, by definition, preemptive. Okay. Shortest job first could be either. The preemptive version is called SRTF, shortest remaining time first. Okay. Multi-level feedback queue is preemptive. Lottery scheduling also preemptive. Okay, so you need to know what those policies are, okay, how they work. Okay, you need to be able to given a scenario which says here are the arrivals of jobs, these are the lengths of jobs, you should be able to figure out for any of those policies what is the completion time. Okay, when will that job finish if they were all collectively scheduled using that policy. We have done several examples of this. Okay, we did round robin, we did shortest job first, we did multi-level feedback queue. So you can expect questions of that flavor. Okay, some scenario, some policy, completion times, wait times. Okay, so you need to be able to compute those. Okay, you should know what a time slice is. And yes, your question there.
Are we going to need to deal with cases of non-zero context switch time?
Are we going to deal with non-zero context switch time? Until now we have said no. It's not very difficult, it just makes your math messy.
Right.
Because I try to have exams that don't require calculators, I will probably not ask you to do that. Okay. But on a homework, that's fair game. So homework, you can use a calculator, or you don't have a bounded time to finish. Okay. So time slices, you need to understand the pros and cons of choosing a small versus a large time slice. We talked about this. Okay. If you have a small time slice, the system appears more interactive because you're rapidly switching between jobs. Everybody gets a their turn to run quickly. Okay. But there are more context switches, and context switches are wasted over it. Okay, so you always want to amortize that context switch overhead over as large a time slice as possible. That argues for choosing larger time slices, but larger time slices makes the system non-interactive. Okay, so you want to strike a balance between these two trade-offs. Okay, interactivity and amortizing the time slice over amortizing the context switch overhead over a larger time slice. Okay, so you need to know what does a small time slice do, what does a large time slice do. Why do you choose something that's neither too small nor too large? Okay. I.O. bound, CPU bound processes, you should know what is an I.O. bound. It's a process that mostly does I.O. with very short bursts of computation. What is CPU bound? Jobs that just do lots of computation with very little or no I.O. Okay. Should you treat them differently for scheduling purposes? Answer is yes. Okay. If you want to basically extract the advantages of shortest job first, you try to give priority to I.O. bound processes so they can do their short bursts and go back to doing I.O. and then you have lots of time to run your CPU bound process. Okay? So typically most schedulers which look like multi-level feedback queues actually treat I.O. bound and CPU bound processes differently. Okay? They favor I.O. bound processes so that that sort of approximate shortest job first. Yes, question.
You say treat differently. I mean, doesn't also feedback queue like effectively treat differently, but it doesn't
specify from the outset, you know, IO bound versus not IO bound. It's simply IO bound ones tend to sink to the bottom because of their nature, right?
Well, stay at the top. CPU bound, yes. Yes, but that is basically you pick the clever policy that is automatically distinguishing between the two without the user actually telling you what type of process. Right? So it is basically, so when your process starts up, you are not telling the OS is IO bound, is CPU bound. You are just specifying a policy saying, what's the test you use to distinguish between the them? Have you used your time slot or not? If you fully used your time slot, you are likely to be a CPU bound process. If you are not used your time slot, you are likely to be an IO bound process. It's a simple observation that the system uses. And then you can basically partition. And that's what is essentially used. So you don't actually label them. But by using the simple observation, you can distinguish between what type behavior a process exhibits. And that is what then the policy actually treats them different. Okay. But the question here is saying, regardless of what policy you use, is there any advantage of treating them differently? And the answer is, if you want to look like you're doing shortest job first, then favor IO bound because they look like short jobs. That's what it was asking. Okay, how do you do it is what the policy actually does, like MLFQ. Okay, so things you should be able to do. This I already said, given a list of processes, arrival times, length of their CPU and IO bursts, etc., etc., compute completion time. Okay, assume context switches might be zero. Given some variant of a scheduling algorithm, should be able to expect or argue what kind of behavior that might exhibit. Okay, some simple tweaks, saying if you instead of doing this, you did that, what do you expect, or how you would expect the CPU times to change, etc. Okay, you can do a little bit of thinking as well. Okay, synchronization, I already covered this, so this is quick. Why do we need it? Okay, so that should, the too much milk was the example there. Define what a mutual exclusion is. Define what a critical section is. That's all there. So we already covered what's a lock, what's a semaphore, what's a monitor. What is this notion of busy waiting and why is it not a good thing to have in your code? Okay. And then basically the hardware level stuff, what is test and set. So I just did all that, so I'm not going to go into the details here, but rather I'll talk about things you should be able to do. Okay? In addition to defining them and knowing the concepts, you should be able to, given some pseudo code, you should be able to explain whether it will work. Okay? So if I say, here is too much milk version 7, and say, will it work or not, you should be able to argue whether it works or not. Or if I give you a variant of some pseudocode of reader, writer, or producer, consumer saying, is this actually going to work? Is there any bug here? You should be at least be able to figure out at a high level. Not that you'll get long stretches of code, some short things, but you should be able to figure that out. More importantly, there's a number 2 here, which I guess I didn't put. You should be able to say, if I give you a small scenario, some variant of readers, writers, something like a simplified version of the candy factory, and say, write some pseudocode using monitors that solves the candy factory. And as an example question, you should be able to say, okay, this is the scenario, these are the condition variables, this is how the pseudocode works. Okay? So, ability to look at pseudocode and reason whether it works or not, ability to write some pseudocode to solve a certain problem using semaphores, locks, or monitors. Those are the 2 things you should be able to do. And then there's a deadlock part, which I think, okay, that's very quickly. The deadlock, 4 conditions for a deadlock. What are the different avoidance detection mechanisms? Okay. What the notion of a safe state, the kind of exercise we did today, banker's algorithm. Okay, he has a system state, reason about whether it's safe or not. Okay, all of the kind of stuff that we did. Okay. So now I'm going to stop here, but I'll say one more thing. Okay, so the smart strategy to study for the test is not to open the book and start reading the first page and go through chapter 7. So a lot of stuff in the book we have skipped. You are not expected to know that material. Okay, the right strategy or the smart strategy is you start with the lecture notes. Okay, make sure you know everything that's on the slides. Right? If you know whatever is said on the slides clearly, it's a good bet that you are going to do well on the exam. Okay? Because everything that I said, be able to write pseudocode, do exercises, we have done several examples of that. Okay? So start from the lecture slides. There are some PDF of lecture notes that are also on the course webpage. Okay? Those are the two places you should start. Not that you should ignore the book, but start there and then go back to the book and refer to the relevant sections and get your concepts clarified or understanding enhanced and so on. Okay? So don't do it the other way. Don't start reading the book without having a clear picture of what parts we have emphasized in the course. I am going to stick to what we have done in the lecture notes and only test you on that, not things that we haven't covered. Okay, because I don't expect you to know that. Yes, question.
This review, you didn't cover like kernel types or like any of that stuff?
The what? Kernel what?
Like kernel types, like macro
kernel. Oh, kernel types. Yes, actually there is, yes, there were lecture 1 and 2 was this note, kernel types and some architecture basics. Okay? Expect some simple questions, nothing very complicated, just to make sure, like short questions. True or false or things like that. Okay, or some tool answer in two sentences. What's a monolithic kernel? So do start from lecture 1. Okay, I mean, those two things I didn't cover here, but you are right. You should expect to know that. Okay. So I'm going to stop here. We ran out of time. We have plenty of time, okay, for you to study. So start with this exam sort of cheat sheets. Work backwards from there. Okay, and I'm here if you have questions, etc.
Thank you.